I don't think people think you can make money in the thing you like. Look at Barbie right now. Barbie's back in a real way. And if you were obsessed with Barbie 3-4 years ago, if you had started a meaningful podcast, an Instagram account, a TikTok, there's a percentage chance that Mattel and Barbie would have reached out to you in these last 6 months or 12 months and paid you $50,000 for a sponsorship if you were the leading. Obviously, you have to be good at this, everyone who's listening.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Vayner Nation, how are you? I'm really excited about this episode of the podcast because anytime you have a guest on the show that's named Mr. Squishy, you know it's got to be decent. It's got to be fun. And that's exactly what this is. It's also pretty entrepreneurial. I'll let Scott, my guest, give you a ton about his journey. I want to use this as a double bubble, as I like to call it. I want to hit on a couple things. One, for the general audience, I've been thinking a lot about side hustles, opportunities. The world's changing. It's just very clear that the way people think about their careers, you're seeing a much more multidimensional aspect where people think about their core job, and then they think about side hustles or having three side jobs to represent the job. And I recently posted something in social about how much of an arbitrage there is for dog walking businesses because so many people bought dogs during COVID and how lucrative that, you know, opportunity is. And it's around a passion that I think a lot of people have. And so that was fun. I've already within weeks gotten a lot of emails from people who are making hundreds of extra dollars a week and are ecstatic because they love dogs. And I think what Mr. Squishy Scott represents in this vending machine conversation we have is actually a huge opportunity for a lot of people listening to the podcast, whether they do it with him, with us, him and I, and our JV around Be Friends, we'll get into that. Or if you find something else you wanna sell. The day I met him, I was like, oh my God, you know, if the internet was around and I found him when I was 16, I would have done this. And so we're gonna talk about the small toys industry. I'm gonna talk about at some point in the podcast why I've teamed up with him. We've launched the VFriends vending machine. This will air probably, we're probably going to be in Chicago doing the National Trading Card Convention where we'll have some vending machine stuff. But we've also talked to a lot of you in the VFriends community, but not in the broader Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V community about this opportunity. So there'll be an opportunity for you to reach out. Dustin, while we're doing this episode, come up with a URL with the VFriends team of where people can email, or not URL, an email where people that are listening that want to take an opportunity in what we're doing together with Scott. But that's all a big setup for a really fun episode where I think people are going to learn a whole bunch. So Scott, why don't you tell the Vayner Nation who you are, what you do, and we'll go into a little bit of your entrepreneurial journey and backstory, and then we'll talk about some of the current opportunities in the marketplace.
Well, I think I'd like to start by my life is about play, passion, persistence, but mostly play. The side hustle has always been part of, I think, everybody's lifestyle surrounding what I've been doing since I've been in high school. I started in high school writing a book, surprisingly, on auctions in Edison, New Jersey. You know, who here remembers or has any relation to Edison, New Jersey?
Me, so sir.
That was where I got my big start. Which was the U.S. customs auctions, the government auctions out of Edison, which
they were on Route 1, right?
Yes, I remember. Yes.
Be careful.
And I got you know, and I'm going to get my high school in trouble a little bit. I left high school early to go to these auctions to buy goods.
Did you go to Edison High or did you go to J.P. Stevens?
I actually went to Morristown. I went to Chester, New Jersey.
Ah, got it.
And so, you know, what was super fun and super fascinating in my transition from high school to college was I just continued that hustle mentality, that idea of, okay, so I'm buying stuff in high school, I'm reselling it. Too bad the internet was not huge back then. I had an AOL address. That was super fun. But my teachers figured out what I was doing. They were like, you know, you're bringing scuba gear, old Bibles, toy sets, you know, can we buy some of them? And all of a sudden I started to get a reputation, and my English teacher, which I'll be honest, school was not my best area of expertise, but my English teacher came to me and said, hey, you should write a small pamphlet. And this pamphlet turned into a book, and this book actually got published. And so I ran into college with a published book that was actually being distributed by Success Magazine. And that leverage, that little bit of leverage, was just a stepping stone that constantly gave me this opportunity to open new doors.
I love that.
And that's the idea of this transition. So I walked into college. I'm a freshman. I have this cool book behind me. I was getting royalties and I wanted a place to spend the money. And so rather than spend it like typical college students, I wanted to invest it.
Okay.
And so I went two directions.
And what year is this, Scott, just for painting a picture?
93.
Understood.
It's, it was a while ago. And
I graduated high school in 94. I mean, we're not, I'm with you right here. I don't know. That seemed very recent. I get where we're not like in the 2000s graduating class anymore, but understood. So you're a couple years ahead of me. Understood. You go into college. You want to invest in. What do you do?
Well, I run into an engineer at the end of my freshman year.
Okay.
And it was Bob Ferris. And he had started a virtual reality company.
Okay.
And he needed investment and he needed some strategic alliances. And I had money at the time. I figured I would invest in his company. I would involve myself in his process. And it was great. And so we took the journey together for the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, because that was the boom of like technology, right? Like we were in it.
Yeah. And so the opportunity came. Disney came knocking and we had a little technology we've been working on, some scent technology, some aroma technology. And I had a choice. I could stay in school or I could invest full time working with Ferris and Ferris Productions at the time. And so I made the leap. To the disappointment of my family, I dropped out of school and I jumped in full force and worked full time for this engineer and this company. We built simulators. And all of a sudden, once Disney came knocking and they used this technology for some of their rides, some of you might be familiar. It was called Soaring Over California. It's now called Soaring, but it has aromas being released on a time-based event. That is the same technology we worked on and we used as a team. And so we leveraged this. Early into my career with Ferris, there was a great camaraderie, but at some point I wanted to do my own thing. And so I made the biggest leap of my life. I gave him back all of his stock for one thing, freedom, mm-hmm. freedom to make my own choices, freedom to try to do my own thing. We left on great terms. He got back most of his company. I got my freedom to build whatever I wanted. My first client was General Motors. I built NASCAR simulators for them, full-scale NASCARs with hydraulics that would give people the idea of racing on their tracks and traveled around the nation with it. Loved doing these products. And we could spend hours with all the clients and all the cool tech that we've built. But the full circle on this is years later, Bob Ferris calls me up and he goes, "Hey, you want to come to New York? I'm going to be ringing the bell. We're going public. I'd like you to stand by my side."
It's very nice.
The amount of respect and empathy and what gratitude he gave to me with that statement, the amount of money gone didn't matter. It was the feeling that I had built something with this gentleman. He gave me the respect of saying, "I want to ring a bell with you in New York City." That was priceless. I to this day, I would still take that moment over the millions of dollars, 100%. And so that has been my series of experiences over the past few years. One of our clients was even Lego. Everybody here loves Lego animations. We were the first company ever to animate Legos and bring Legos to life. And it was an amazing tour. Lego came to us and they said, "Okay, we're launching this new series of products. We'd like to animate this in 3D with aromas and have you travel around." And one of the coolest things is we travel on this huge trailer that we'd animated and brought to the Toys R Us's and the Targets of the world. And this activation was about experiencing if Legos and animations could meld together. We all know it does now.
Of course.
But the kids would actually come out. And this is what was amazing about it. The kids would actually come out and visit me with their Lego creations. And that was so heartwarming to me. The fact that these children would come out and be like, "Oh, look what I built." And then I could be like, "Look what I built." And we would share that moment. And I realized that fascination I had, the connection I wanted with the customer. Yep. I wanted that customer to feel like they were listened to. I wanted the customer to feel, even if it was a 10-year-old kid showing me his Lego sculpture, it was the coolest thing ever for 10 months. And part of the contract, and Gary, you'll appreciate this, is I wanted about 30,000 Legos when I was done. And I backed my trailer into Connecticut and have them dump Legos. And why? Because I wanted to build my conference table out of Legos.
I love it.
I just thought it would be fun. So I spent the next few months on the floor building a conference table out of Legos. And it's that type of experience that I've carried.
Let me ask you a question, Scott. I think just to bring a lot of value to a lot of people that are listening to this podcast, what do you think has allowed you to keep the joyful adolescence part in your life? Because I would argue, as I continue to go down my journey of life professionally and personally, I wonder, and I think a lot about, why am I happier than most people? And it weighs on me in a great way. One, it keeps me grateful on a 24/7, 365, even when I am dealing with challenges. You know, last week was a challenging week for me personally and professionally, and yet I'm just still like genuinely happy. And so I think about it a lot because I'm also a person who has a large audience now, and I'm a good communicator. And much like I have spent the last 15 years enabling people to find angles in business and marketing mentally. But I do find my ability to hold on to my youth, me being childish, as a good thing, as a strength.
Yes.
My never fully converting to full-pledged adulthood and holding on to 2 to 30%. I don't know if I've done the work yet to realize what the number is between the 2 and 30% that I have in me, but I can tell you whether it's two, let's say it's 2 or 3%. I have a very funny feeling that that 2 or 3% in my mix right now has a huge impact on my joy and my peace of mind, and honestly, my professional success. So I'm jumping in here a little bit just to bring macro value to, because I know this can impact, regardless if people are listening right now or into collectibles, IPs, entrepreneurship, this can help everyone who's listening. Do you have a sense of why you've been able to hold on to this youthful? When I hear a man has a career, you know, and decides to take months to build a conference table out of Legos, that's a level of youthfulness that I don't even possess. So and I know you a little bit now because we're doing business together with BeFriends and your vending machine business, and I find you to be really likable. I really like you. And I feel like this has something to do with it. And I'm curious if you've consciously held on to it subconsciously, or was it subconscious and then it became conscious and you've doubled down on it? Break this down, because I think we can change a person's life right now.
Passion. You look at it directly at passion. What do you do on your off time? What do you do that you love? Do you love sneakers? Do you love building? Do you love helping people? Do you love playing? Do you like changing people's lives? Do you like coaching? Whatever your passion is, whatever you spend your off time, the time that is most valuable. We all have the 24 hours in a day, but what do you spend when you have the most valuable resource at your fingertips? Where do you spend it? Is it social media? That's fine. Is it playing with toys? Great. Building Lego.
By the way, social media, what are you consuming? Like people are like, you're talking about, my first book was, literally this little book right there is literally Cash In on Your Passion. So you can imagine I'm excited and surprised by your answer. Like, you know, I don't think people think you can make money in the thing you like. I think if people who like to thrift in Brooklyn and San Francisco and all these Austin on the weekends realized that they could make $250,000 a year in profit on thrifting full time, literally waking up at 7 a.m. on Monday, having breakfast and being ecstatic instead of going to the office to go to 16 Salvation Armies and 13, you know, other thrift stores, and then can't wait for Friday because that's estate sales, and can't wait for Saturday because that's garage sales. I don't think that person realizes that if they didn't buy just for themselves what they want to wear to be cool, that they could buy the other 87 t-shirts that are at the thrift store that they're buying for $3 or $7 and can sell for $29 on all these platforms, right? Ari or eBay or things of that nature. I don't think the thrifter right now listening thinks, or the person that's just fully upset. I just watched a Ray Romano movie on Amazon, which was really good, by the way, something about Queens. And in the movie, he plays a part of a dad who's got this kid, Sticks, this basketball kid. But in it, the dad is clearly obsessed with Rocky. Like he just references Rocky the movie. There's a scene in the movie where he puts in a DVD and he takes out Rocky II. And as we're sitting here, I'm like, the person that's fully immersed in Rocky, or look at Barbie right now. Barbie's back in a real way. And if you were obsessed with Barbie 3-4 years ago, if you had started a meaningful podcast, an Instagram account, a TikTok, there's a percentage chance that the Barbie movie company would have reached, Mattel and Barbie would have reached out to you in these last 6 months or 12 months and paid you $50,000 for a sponsorship if you were the leading. Obviously, you have to be good at this, everyone who's listening. But I don't think the person that is a lawyer making $319 or the person that's a retail store manager making $87 thinks they can make that same number about Barbie. And I know they can.
Yes, they can. Yeah. And it's even more than that. It's authenticity. So you've got to mix passion with authenticity. If you take those two together, if you're authentic about what you're talking about, it's not about just the hustle. It's about believing what you're talking about, believing what you're flipping or what you're invested in. I mean, you and I talked briefly on the phone and we had such a connection, such an electric connection with who we are as people, like just ingrained as individuals, enthusiastic, passionate, authentic. And it came across on a webcam.
Yes.
And it was just,
I'm not sure if we use the term webcam anymore, but wait a day, that's 90 guys. That was a fun opportunity. Keep going.
I'm sure I use so many terms.
Oh, bro, don't even get started with me. Not only do I use ridiculous terms, I can't pronounce 33% of the things I say. So yeah, I'm right here with you. But I agree with you. I think the authenticity matters. But keep going.
You know, and so what I like to look at is, and I've met a lot of people who make a lot of money who are miserable at their jobs. But they go out every weekend and they're boating with their friends, or they're going out every weekend and they're doing wine tastings. And I'm like, why don't you do boating? Why don't you do wine tasting? Right,
because the world believes that you got to eat shit Monday through Friday to then enjoy the weekend. And by the way, this gets into another reason that school fucks me up so heavily, because I think it's being taught subconsciously there from childhood. I couldn't agree with you more. The thought of eating shit Monday through Friday to be able to enjoy Saturday and Sunday. This is why people are like, we need 4-day work weeks, because subconsciously people are like, fuck man, between kids and responsibilities and laundry and other shit, I can't even enjoy my 2 fucking days that I barely get. And like the thought of and by the way, Scott, I lived this life from K through 12 and even further into college. I understand what it feels like to like look forward to the weekend or to vacations or hoping it snows or hoping I get sick. I spent 10 years of my life hoping I would get sick because it meant that I could miss school. That's how much I didn't want it. The thought of doing that from 22 years old to 70 is insane to me.
It's miserable. It's miserable. It's funny for me. I like Mondays. I actually look forward to Monday. Monday for me is exciting because I'm raring to go. Everybody got to relax on Sunday. I let them have their time. But man, Monday, I can get a hold of it. I can get going. I can figure out what's going on in my world. Mondays are great. It's a start of a week. It's a restart. It's a rekindling of what I'm trying to do. So for me, it's about passion. It's about authenticity. It's finding what you spend your time on and monetarily make that part of your life.
And by the way, unlike if we were doing this in 1965 and we were at a conference, not on the internet, talking about this, today, that's practical, meaning everyone's listening right now, like, all right, you two fucking fantasy land guys, like, fuck you. I have a mortgage. I have children. I have debt. My big point is, in 1967, you're right. Like, what do? You get home at 7 and like, but in 2023, you get home at 7 and you can either go to the bar, join a softball team, watch Netflix, decompress and try to enjoy some part of your day because you just went 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 hours. Or you can say, fuck, I got to get out of this. And if I do my podcast or my channel or my side hustle on, you know, 8 p.m. after I do a little family time to 10 p.m. instead of playing video games or pool or darts or watching TV, those 2-3 hours Monday through Friday can add up to 10 hours in a week. You do that for a year or two, you might be able to build the thing at night that gets you off the drug that you don't get during the day.
Yes. And speaking of family time, the idea is, how do you incorporate your family into what you do? And for many years, I've got 2 daughters, 10 and 5, and they are my world. And I love to try to incorporate different things into what I do with what.
Well, you're fortunate. You sell mini toys and it's cool to them. As you can imagine, if somebody's listening and they do concrete production, I'm not sure that 7-year-old Johnny's going to love that. But to your point, if more people went into their passion in business, it is more likely that going thrifting or you know, supporting the podcast on the Muppets. Like, literally, I know today if someone is the most educated and most passionate listening right now with the Muppets, I'm talking Kermit the fucking Frog, that if they become a content producer at scale and do it 2 hours every night, that a year from now, they could be flabbergasted on the opportunities that come to them. And by the way, everybody who's listening, why do I know this? This is an hypothesis for me. I've been talking about this for 15 years. I have the unlimited inbox email receipts from people, unlimited, hundreds and hundreds, and now thousands and thousands of people who are just like who's listening right now saying, this isn't real. Some people are, Scott, do you know some people are listening right now in their car or walking their dog or exercising and are even frustrated by us saying, do you realize what's going on in the world? There's a recession, there's a this, but this conversation needs to be had because it's true.
Yes, happiness and mental health are so key to my life. And I navigate what I do and the choices I make and who I do business with because of those things.
Before we run out of time, so what happens? How do you get to the small toys?
How'd you get there? I made big toys for a while. Simulators, General Motors.
Right.
I've made Toyota Baja simulators.
Established.
Huge big things. But the problem was I was feast and famine. A lot of the times what would happen is I would build a product for 6 months and then I would be waiting for 3 months for the cycle of the new client, the new product would come in. It'd be 1, 2, 3 a year. And I wanted to affect more people. I wanted to do more with the public. And the opportunity came, I was at the New York International Toy Fair. And somebody happened to come up to my booth and they said, hey, I know you're building these really cool books. I had transitioned surprisingly into tech. So, you know, you're talking books, right? Now, the tech I did was books that come to life. So the whole idea was you read a book, you get your phone, you scan the book, and the book comes to life. The dinosaur crawls out, the princess waves a wand.
What year was that?
This was 2005.
So when you say scan phone, like, we're not in smartphone area, so I'm a little confused. Yeah.
We just started the transition between mobile webcam to mobile phone. The iPhone had the standard, you know, front-facing, rear-facing cameras. We were able to now to have people use a mobile phone. There's enough phones and families to actually have iPads that were available. And so we thought we were on the cusp of something big, and I went into it hard. I went into this whole idea of what I call a digital frontier. Part of the other business that I run is the idea of how do you do physical with digital.
So it had to be a little bit later though, right? Because the iPhone came out in June of 2007.
So we started with webcam in 2005.
I see, now I'm following. Thank you, because I was confused. Got it. So the book would do the web, got it. Originally, the book, when you scan it, would be webcam, it would be on desktop. And then thank you, because I was a little confused. Keep going.
And I wanted to disrupt print media. I wanted to disrupt puzzles, charts, tattoos, stickers, books. And love this idea of a digital bridge between physical products and the digital need of kids. Parents want to buy something digital. Parents want to buy something physical. Kids want something digital. It's really hard as a Christmas gift to open up an app. Yeah. But will a parent buy a book? Yes. If that book comes with an app, will the kid use the book more? Yes, it's a different type of storytelling.
My favorite part of the world now, as we sit together, and this, again, everyone who's listening, I'm jumping in, though you might be frustrated, like, don't interrupt Scott or this and that. I'm really trying to bring value. We are really in a digital world. This physical digital combo is so real. It's funny, we're talking right now, a headline that caught my attention this morning as I was walking to work was the Oppenheimer or whatever, the movie crushed, right? Like 235 million. And it's just like Rolling Loud went down in Miami this weekend. I saw what happened at VCon, record numbers for the National in Chicago that we're going to this week. Like, we were in the house for so long. We're so immersed in our digital devices. Like, it's just very clear, not just the kids, but the grownups, because really our behaviors with digital and the real world are more similar than people think. From boomers, there's plenty of boomers sitting at their desktop computer right now for 7 hours shopping and yelling at each other or supporting each other and on their desktop computer or laptop. So it's just very clear to me that the physical and digital world is like very real and healthy. Both are very healthy. And when you can be smart and blend them together and let them work together, it's really cool. Earlier, if you were listening to the podcast, you heard a sound in the background from my mic. It was because my friend Bridget's here. a former Vayner employee who's like friends with a ton of people. She's just visiting the office. She decided to sit in. I hope when you were talking about the vending machine, I have one here in the office. And she took one and she opened it. And I saw her while you were talking, scan the QR code. I wasn't sure if it was working or not. So I took the piece of paper and I did on my own phone. And I was like, man, people are going to buy this little toy for 50 cents, these VFriends toys. They're going to get the little piece of paper. There's a QR code post-COVID, pre-COVID. I'm getting some sort of very small percentage of people knowing what to do with that thing and scanning it. Post-COVID, everyone from 5 to 105 now knows what to do with a QR code. Every, you know, the amount of kids with an iPad, the amount of parents with an iPhone, being able to scan it goes to obviously to our video on YouTube. That combo of digital and physical is pretty rad.
It's for me, I saw it back in early 2005 of where this bridge would be. And we talk about failure a lot. I love failing. I failed so much in my career with so many products I have on a shelf that didn't go anywhere.
Of course.
But I have, and I love it. I love failing because it shows me a door that closes and I need to do something that opens.
You also tried. Do you know how many people that also are yelling at us behind this episode right now, like that's not real, also never try?
Oh, I mean, just for the audience to understand, I built, I think, 11 books, 15 puzzles, 5 charts, tattoos and stickers, and it failed miserably. The public was not ready for this concept.
Yeah, I loved it. Too early. The webcam thing, a lot of parents didn't know how to use webcams, didn't have enough yet. The kids in front of a computer, like it makes sense in 2005, 6, 7.
It just didn't work, and it still is a hard sell today. I mean, we're talking, I've been on QVC, I've been on The View, and I've tried all of it, and it's just there's a disconnect. People want right now, still today, the book to be a book, and that's fine. And this is the transition to the squishy toys, and so I realized, okay, how do I find a platform that works? And at the show at the New York International Toy Fair, I was debuting all these Pop-R products, ran into a group that had these cute little pencil toppers, and they had what's called an MMOG, a massive multiplayer online game. And they were trying to get these little pencil toppers to work on an MMOG. And, you know, it was fascinating to me because their users and everything that they were doing with the digital physical connection was working. Inevitably, with what they had, I inevitably bought out their distribution rights, bought out their IP early on. And I transformed that entire product into what today is Squishland. And here's some crazy numbers. I know we're on the cusp of Barbie. So what do you think is the most popular best-selling toy ever?
Of all time?
All time.
The most popular selling toy of all time is Slinky, the Pet Rock. Play-Doh, what's that thing? The pink stuff. Anyway, go ahead. What's the answer?
Hot Wheels. Four billion Hot Wheels have been sold. Okay.
Big shout out Mattel. What a monster brand. By the way, big shout out for all the garage sailors listening. Hot Wheels, Redline. Just for everybody knows, back in the way back day, the Hot Wheels that were sold, the tires had a little red line in the middle. So when I garage sale, I can literally, I'm so knowledgeable about this shit. I can go to a box of Hot Wheels, look at all of them and pull out the red line tire ones, which are like 50, 80, 200 bucks a piece. And you can buy them for a quarter at a garage sale.
And that's what I love. I mean, the next one after Hot Wheels is Barbie. Okay. So that corresponds with the movie. Barbie sold about a billion Barbies over
time. Yeah. And now that Barbie, you know, when they brought in the new CEO, he was very clear that I'm going to make this a media company. We've seen it with Transformers and all that. Hasbro's done a good job with that. Like, you're telling me that we're not going to see an epic either Cars-like, Thomas the Train-like, or even Fast and Furious-like Hot Wheels movie in the next 3-4 years? Clearly, they're going to do that based on what just happened with Barbie.
And so when you look at, like, the top 10 toys, they're mostly retail toys. Barbie, you know, since 1959, about a billion, you know, same thing with Hot Wheels, about 4 billion. So the top 10 toys, and then you go down and you get Tamagotchi. Okay.
Right.
And Tamagotchi is, again, it's a toy we grew up with. You know, these things sold about 83 million pieces and they started in 1996.
That little fucking keychain, every girl in my school had that.
And so it's also about barrier to entry with a lot of this stuff. And so just to give the audience some type of grandiose idea, between toys, and this is kind of how I sometimes introduce myself. I've made a toy that most people played with, but never really knew who it was and who made it. And Squishland, these cute little pencil toppers that are, you know, what we're making, they're squishy, 250 million pieces. So, and our success is not based on being front and center in a retail center in Toys R Us. Our success comes from vending machines. And that's what everybody needs to understand is pennies can make sense. Okay. So vending machines are the first things you see when you walk through the door. It's the last thing you see walking out the door. It's got the best branding potential in retail ever. And you and I
on the vending toys and such, right? How many and you may not know this answer, and there may not be an answer, or there might be a number that the industry throws around at the vending convention shows, but how many stores, doors, have vending machines in them with toys or stickers or such?
About 30,000.
Yeah, it's a lot of locations in the U.S. I know people hear that number, and it's not like a billion. You know, we're so accustomed now to hear like 100,000 or a million. 30,000 seems small, but it's so many. Think about what like, let me say it a different way. Think about right now getting in a car and going to 25 stores. Now that sounds like a lot. So you can imagine 30,000 stores in America having these vending machines.
I mean, that's
and that's 30,000 have toys or stickers. That's probably different than candy, right?
Right. No, this is just 1-inch toys. So there's 2-inch toys. There's claw machines. There's stickers. There's tattoos.
I see. So it's way more. You're talking just 1-inch toys. There's 30,000. I see.
It's exponential. It's huge. I mean, the last census was about 1 million heads of vending in America. 1 million heads. So you go into a toy store, there could be 12 heads in a store. So you're fighting for real estate space of those 12 heads. So what I'm trying to get at is in vending, most people disregard it. But for me, it's one of the best retail centers, and nothing in vending had been streamlined. Everything in vending for years had been very tchotchke based. It was a clear capsule with a plastic toy inside. And so what I did was I wanted to come around and say, okay, I wanted to give people in the vending industry a retail experience. I wanted them to go and spend their 50 cents, their dollar. And when they came out, they bought and they got a fully wrapped capsule. It even had, you know, all the warning labels. It had your barcode that you could use. And once we did that, we exploded. And retail came knocking. Retail went, oh, you make these toys? I'm like, yes. And they're all unique IPs. And so what we tried to do is we disrupted an industry by increasing the quality and the standard in which people wanted to have the experience. We knew that the people were out there buying something. And so for you and me, our childhood and vending is very sacred. It was the first toy I got to buy with my own money.
Yep.
And that's huge. So
it's also for every parent that's listening with a 3 to 7 year old, it's like the greatest gift for you when you're trying to get some, you know, errands finished, because for 50 cents or when I was growing up, 25 cents, you can keep your kid busy for the 45 minutes you need while you're in the supermarket or the convenience store or what have you.
Right. And you think about it, like whether we're talking about the side hustle of, let's say you like sneakers. Well, there's a huge industry now of how to display your sneakers. That's only populated in the last few years. These sneaker walls that are backlit, that are now motorized. And then the same thing goes for the vending. There are so many ways to disrupt these industries. And some, we just saw that with Threads. So, you know, even in social media, we've got these opportunities. And so what we did is once this came to this little capsule that got wrapped, then retail came and they said, hey, we'd like you to have an end cap. And so this blue, I don't know, right there.
I see it.
That's our end cap. That's all vending toys that have been moved into the store that do. So we're in vending and we're in the store at the same time. So we're getting our IP doubled down.
Before we run out of time, because I want to go into the part, we team up. We obviously do VeeFriends mini figures together. Really excited about it. We're kind of launching now. What really caught my attention when we were talking was the concept of, sure, there's a lot of people in my world that own 6 stores, 15 stores. They're the head of marketing or partnerships at a company that has 1,000 stores or 500. So I was really excited about it. But the part that got me really going was the concept of the people listening right now that don't have a store could buy the vending machine and then go to their local pizza shop or their burger stop or their bowling alley and get the vending machine in and share in the revenue with the place. That was the 16-year-old me. That was, you know, full transparency. It was my instant connection to you because Edison boys that like never grew up. And two, oh shit, because I think we're selling them for $750.
Oh, it's a great price.
Where people can literally buy it, go to their whatever, you know, there's just so many fucking towns in America. And like, there's always the cliche, like hot spot that is a one-off. Yeah. And if you go there and you're like, hey, Mr. Johnson, I'll give you 50 cents on the dollar of everything here. Can you just plop this down and drill it into the front of your store? That super excites me.
Well, I think the idea is everyone can now have their own little business. And this is like a side hustle. We supply the machine, the product, and you and I are building a product line. This product line is awesome. I was telling my team about what we've developed for you guys because it has smell and it has glitter and it has glow and it has detailed. It has all these amazing pieces that usually I save one of those for a vending line, but you get them all.
Yeah. I mean, I come from trading cards, so I need all the rarities, all the hits, all the, like it's been crazy to see some people. We obviously previewed it at VCon. Okay. Real quick, everyone, cause we're going to run out of time. If you are interested in being a vendor for the V Friends vending machines, email V, we're making this very easy, V at vfriends.com, V-E-E-Friends.com. V-Friends is V-E-E-F-R-I-E-N-D-S.com. So V at vfriends.com and say you have interest. They're $750 a piece. Then you buy the little toys, you make margin on each toy. And best of all is the first official machines going into Wine Library, my dad's store. He's very excited about it. He called me, this is how crazy my dad is. He's like, hey, can I get the rare ones in our machine? He's gonna lose, by the way, on the record, Wine Library's probably gonna lose money because my dad's gonna wanna support me because he's the best and probably put it into a way too important spot in front of the store where he should have probably put wine that he can make margin on. But I was like, no, Dad, we can't do that for you. But I'm excited about that. And I'm excited, that's for V-Friends. But in general, I think this is a viable side hustle for a lot of people. Yes. You know, just getting into the vending game, either adding it to the store you own, but most people listening don't own stores, being a middleman and woman, buying machines, and then finding locations that have enough traffic that sell through, specifically places with kids coming through.
Well, I mean, it's even more important. If you have kids, this is a great way to teach them how to run a business.
Yeah, I agree.
I've got a 10-year-old daughter who went to a museum and decided, hey, we should put a unit there. Well, Dad, why? Because we go there almost every summer. So we stuck one of our units up at Barizona in Arizona. And so we get in free. All the money they make is theirs to kind of spend and whatever, do whatever they want to clean the machine. It's their business. And so they understand the logistics of everything that are going on. It's
to your point, it's really lemonade stand 2.0.
Yeah. No, 100%.
Lemonade stand's awesome. But like actually having to sell in a machine to a grown-up establishment, managing inventory and checking on it every week or you know day or whatever it is to like be like, oh, we got to fill it up.
Yeah, it's exciting for them. No, they come to it and they see it dumped out. They collect all the money. They put the money through a coin counter I have here. They get to stack them together. We go to the bank. We get cash. I get my cut. They get their cut. You know? I told them I got to drive them, so I get a cut of what they're.
Yeah, there. Man, you're running a business here. No free rides, kids.
No, but you know, here's the thing is that even my 5-year-old has a job. She picks up all the squishies on the floor. She gets to keep them. But, you know, the idea simply is this is a side hustle that you can do. It makes good money. You are going to have an amazing scent of emails over the next few years of people doing this. And they're going to have great stories for you. I look forward to those heartwarming stories of parents and their kids. Stores doing this.
So everybody who's listening, obviously there's the B-Friend thing, but we're going to sell out of those machines pretty quickly. We may even, by the way, I apologize up front. We're going to be at the National where a lot of collector stores are going to be there. We'll probably get close to sell out of the machines there. So A, I apologize if when you email V at bfriends.com if we're kind of out. B though, I'm just one IP. Scott's in the overall business. So Scott, how do people find you if they want to explore more and get educated, potentially be a vendor for your stuff or other stuff or be a wholesaler or a one-off person? What's the best way to connect with you?
best way to connect with us is one of the sites is brandvendingproducts.com. So that's B-R-A-N-D, vendingproducts.com, or Squishland. I'm known as Mr. Squishy. If you find me, I'll tell you the story on how I got the nickname. It's incredibly sweet. It's very endearing. So find me.
And what's your email? Because that's sometimes the lowest point of friction.
Yeah, it's S-J-O-C-H-I-M at brandvendingproducts.com. Connect with me. Ask me any questions you've got.
You couldn't come up with a longer URL? I mean, brand vending. But listen, trust me, I'm a mess too. Like, I've made the mistake too. But like, you know, Scott, maybe we can like really crush this Be Friends thing together. And maybe maybe you can go buy a three-letter domain at bvp.com. Because I mean, I would misspell brand vending products.
You know what? At the end of the day, I could give people.
Do you have a Gmail?
I have an AOL address.
That's even cooler. By the way, I'm actually thinking about getting a Hotmail or AOL address on some retro like Brooklyn hipster shit and be like, yo, I'm Gary at Hotmail.com. Feels like we're like inches away from that being the new swag.
I love it. So come find me. I'll let you know about Mr. Squishy and I'll let you know how
we can buy up every I think I'm about to buy up a ton of Hotmail and AOL accounts that are one name things and like flip them because these fucking hipsters are gonna get into this. It's so obvious to me.
Yes. 100%. And so,
you can have a lot of side hustles today. You can be in the vending business. You can be in the email retro flipping business. Anyway, bfriends.com. If you want to see, we've got a vending part on our website. Scott, I really appreciate it. Parting thoughts. I'll give you the last minute.
Be passionate about what you do. Be playful with what you do. Know that family comes first for me. But at the end of the day, if you look to your right, someone is more successful. And if you look to your left, someone is less successful. You are in the middle, you are okay, and you are balanced.
I love that, brother. Really good show. Thank you. I'll see you in Chicago. Looking forward to having a lot of fun. And we'll talk soon.
Sounds good. See ya.